Let me tell you a story. There was a time, long ago, when speaking was a ceremony. This was before written laws and books and all the other little boxes we've got to put words in now. Back then, everything had voice. The land, the people, the animals. It was all tribes, and words were a tribe of their own, a ceremony we could share with each other. An allowance that cut across species, connecting crow and woman and cedar and stream, because everything was connected in those days. Still is, I guess. We don't see the pattern of it so clearly anymore. What we said had weight in those days, because its effects could carry on for generations. We didn't speak about the world, we spoke the world into being. Those times are gone now, but every once in a while something stirs that old tribe, and some of those words wake up, and then, for a moment, anything can happen.
Welcome back to Walking Away from Arcadia. I'm Simon. Today, Victor and I are going to be talking about glamour and banality and how they work together in the game. What is glamour?
In the early books, there was this really heavy emphasis on creativity. Glamour was everything glamorous in the world, art and performance and music. And then as supplements started coming out, we started seeing fae that came from dreams but weren't so much tied into the artist relationship with dreams. They were animist, they were creatures of the land. The Nunahi, the Gillydu, the Inanime, aren't exactly creatures of the land, and neither are the Nunahi exactly, although a lot of them have strong land ties. A couple of the Kiths are tied to a location, like the Gillydu. But the Inanime are creatures of a physical item. They're a fire's dream of being alive, a stream's dream of being alive, and so glamour changed a little bit. Simon, you had a really interesting observation about a better way to look at glamour to deal with all the different ways that all the different fae deal with it. You just looked at it as potential. You want to talk a little bit about how you reframed that?
With some of the prequel material in Dark Ages Fae and in Wicked Graceful Masks, neither of which blends particularly well with the dreaming, but in both of those, they have a more generic power trait. In Dark Ages, they have mists, and in Exalted, they use essence, but also this thing they have called gossamer. But in both of those cases, it represents the potential of non-being more than the actuality of being. You have, and even in glamour, it's the ability to introduce a thing that doesn't yet exist into existence. You use it to make chimera. You use it to open trods, which are paths into basically the huge collection of non-existence that's the dreaming. And it's less a thing itself, and it's more a space. It's a negative. It's the potential for inspiration. It's the potential for creation. It's the potential of shape rather than things actually being shaped.
Yeah, and I really like that view of glamour. And I have to admit, this comes partially to the fact that in my personal life, I do a fair bit of studying of occult concepts. I don't want to necessarily say I'm an occultist. That implies a level of practice that, you know, doesn't apply, but I find a lot of the lenses of paganism and occult and how they view the world to be engaging, useful, enlightening. And there's a concept in Kabbalah called the Four Worlds, and it basically comes down to the creative process, but it's everything goes through this. The idea that existence goes through the creative process, and the top world is just emergence. Everything is, you know, complete shifting, moving, wild, chaotic mass there, but an idea, something that really exists, like my smartphone at some point was dependent on all these moving, seemingly unrelated things that were going to come together. And then the second world is sort of when those things all collide, like ideas, disparate, random things that happened in your life that you wouldn't think were related, but they came together and you had that aha moment. And that's kind of descending into the second world. And then the third world is when you start to design it and you could describe it to another person and it kind of exists because another person understands it, but whatever the thing is hasn't been made. And then the final world is I've made this thing, this piece of art, this piece of music. But everything goes through that, you know. Granite and marble, you know, were once silt, were once these other elements, were once living things that had shells that then broke down, that then were compressed. And the idea that all of reality goes through that distillation process. And the Fae are really kind of all about that. You know, while Graceful Wicked Masks and Dark Ages Fae don't map cleanly to Changeling, they're very clearly meant to be prequels. And from a historical, conceptual, what were the Fae before they got totally wrapped up with humanity, they do serve as kind of useful prequels, if you think about it in those terms. And then Changelings with the Fae inside of humans, they're now much more closely tied to these final manifestations of glamour, and so they're a lot more concrete, they're a lot more connected to the things that are how glamour is presented in the game. But they're all tied to different forms of it. And so when you think, well, what is this thing really in the abstract? What did it start as? Going back and looking at the other games and thinking of it in those terms, I found to be really useful. I really liked Simon's take on that.
Yeah, and just given the way glamour and banality interact, like, glamour exists in this delicate state that can be disrupted by the noise of everyday life, and you end up with this thing that isn't so much a known, but it's an unknown. I practice Zen meditation, and in Zen meditation, you're not really trying, you're not trying much more than you're trying, and you end up with trying to cultivate this state of not thing rather than thing. You're not thinking, you're leaving the space for thought without actively guiding it, kind of a thing. With the way banality interacts with glamour, you can see some of that in Zen. There's a particular poem about a butterfly getting into the Zen temple and distracting everybody who would have been enlightened at that moment. And it's that sort of
thing.
That's
fantastic.
Yeah, I love that story because it's a beautiful thing that totally messes up your life. And banality isn't necessarily bad, just like glamour isn't necessarily good.
No, and that's one thing that I think is interesting looking at, not so much Graceful Wicked Masks, because banality is a construct there, but it really, really ephemeral early echoes of it. But in Dark Ages Fae, you have mists, which is kind of the glamour equivalent, but not quite. And you have weaving, which is kind of the banality equivalent, but not quite, because there are definite glamour elements to both of those, and there are definite banality elements to both of those. And it's like the axis just got turned totally on its side, because the idea behind mists and weaving is mists is this raw force of the fairy. And it's just, it's roiling wild potential. And weaving is what you use to kind of shape it into something structured, to form an oath, to build a cantrip, a thing that's repeatable that you can do again. And if you're just using mists, you're generally unleashing, and it's kind of wild and uncontrolled. And then you move into modern Changeling, and glamour is used for weaving actions. And banality is this horrible kind of toxic thing in the setting, and you see, if you look back at Dark Ages Fae, you can see how the Fae, before they were pushed all the way to this extreme, sort of held these two things in balance in a healthier way most of the time. I mean, it's World of Darkness, so it was not healthy all the time. You could fall off that knife's edge. But generally speaking,
they most of the time had kind of a healthy, unhealthy back and forth relationship with both of these forces. And you move forward into Changeling the Dreaming, and this kind of goes along with the idea of having lost everything and the shattering, but you can see how they were altered and almost destroyed to the point where the fundamental forces of their existence were mixed and then re-ripped apart into these different things that are honestly both kind of toxic in their own way. Glamour becomes weird and addictive and maddening, and banality just completely drains you out of what you are. And I think that relationship with the power trait is interesting, especially glamour is a source of madness, because glamour, too much glamour, prevents you from having a grounding in who you are, your identity, not just as a human, but even as a changeling, and pushes you towards bedlam. If your glamour goes above your banality plus your willpower, I think, you just right. go into bedlam. And if your
banality is higher than your glamour plus your willpower.
That's right, yeah. Then you're unmade,
both of those,
I think.
Yeah, both of those conditions kind of reflect an extinction of half of yourself. When you go into bedlam, your human self is completely extinguished. And then when you go into, undoing, your fae self is completely extinguished.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think Changeling might be the only game where the power trait is actually presented as dangerous that way. Blood can... I mean, it has to be tainted. Like, there are very weird situations where blood can become dangerous, but generally as a vampire, you want more blood. Gnosis is not dangerous, although rage certainly is. Quintessence really isn't presented as dangerous, and pathos is not dangerous. You want as much pathos as you can get your hands on. You just don't want angst. And so Changeling is the one game where the primary power trait, it's glorified and it's, you know, really hyped up as this amazing idealized thing in all of the fiction. Oh, I want glamour, but it's a lie. And unlike a lot of weird inconsistencies in Changeling, sometimes they don't seem like they're intentional. That difference always seemed intentional to me. The way they talk about glamour is, this is what you believe. No, really. This is what you believe. Don't pay attention to those bedlam rules too closely. I mean, you're going to play with those rules, but don't pay attention to them as a character, because you wouldn't as a character, because no one wants to, like, look into the toxic part of themselves they love, you know. And it also reframes the Dantane. It's I like that element of Changeling a lot.
I actually really enjoy Changeling not having a morality trait, because it's kind of built into the system. You don't have, don't do that, that's going to make you less human. You just have, yeah, you're less human now. Or, oh, really? You think you want to resist that cantrip by disbelieving it? I guess.
I mean, there are probably people that would argue that's the equivalent of a morality trait, but it's not like humanity.
No.
It's, or the morality traits they built into Chronicles. It's much more organic, which I appreciate.
They continue that in Dark Ages Fae a little bit, because in Dark Ages Fae, if you went too far into weaving, then you basically became a modern changeling, plus or minus a little bit. And if you went too far into mists, you suddenly lost the ability to perceive the real world, which is basically madness.
Basically, I mean, that keeps bedlam as a thing, which I do appreciate. And I read the rules for bedlam recently in Graceful Wicked Masks, because they have bedlam as well. And as much as the themes of Graceful Wicked really don't map forward to the themes of Changeling, it's a much more obvious prequel than Dark Ages Fae was in a lot of ways. And it was interesting reading the idea of bedlam for creatures that didn't have that human half at all, that barely had a concept of emotion and psychological structure the way we would think of it. Even the Dark Ages Fae had a lot more of that defined than the Fair Folk, but they still had bedlam. And it's a more discrete, temporary thing for them. It's the equivalent of all of the creatures in Exalted have basically a morality dynamic where they can't push themselves too far down a certain road, or they go a little nuts temporarily. It's kind of the off balance for how powerful the game is. And so it was built into that sort of space for the fair folk, but that they framed it around Bedlam, and I, as a changeling and to a lesser extent Dark Ages Fae player, can't help but see it in that context. It was interesting to contemplate that this has always been there.
Yeah, and in Wicked Masks, you get a lot more of the. You get a lot of little hints at what the dreaming's made out of, and you see a lot more of the interplay between the Fae within reality and the Fae outside of reality. In that, in Wicked Masks, you have the Fae passing into unshaped space, which they don't call the dreaming yet. And interacting with unshaped Fae in a way that discreetly benefits the Fae who came from existence. And I don't know if they ever went out and actually said it, but it's at least implied that the unshaped is getting, apart from vicarious thrills of temporary mortality, they're also getting a fair amount of weaving energy from that interaction, and they're able to persist in a way that unshaped with no relationship to reality aren't.
They did say that actually. I was reading that section recently, and they said specifically the relationship to questing shaped into unshaped, the reason the unshaped even allow it, because the unshaped Fae kind of hate the shaped Fae, is that very element. You know, the unshaped, if you think about them in these glamour terms from modern changeling, are pure distilled glamour, pure distilled potential, and they are no good at shaping it. They don't know what to do with all of that possibility. A good relation in terms of what it would be like that feeling you have when you're looking at a menu that's way too large. There are a million items on the menu and they're all completely different. And anyone who's talked about custom design work says total custom design, you'll never get any customers. There are ways of shaping and weaving it, to use changeling terms, down into something that is a set of choices the human mind can process and deal with. Total blank slate. There are only a handful of very creative people that can do anything with that. And an unshaped that doesn't have these questing shapes come into them are just that. They're just wild potential and no ability to channel it. When the shaped come into them, they basically, every time they quest, they give the unshaped a little kernel of knowledge about reality without forcing the unshaped to go into reality and be diminished. And it gives them, that's what they use to create their emanations and to create their graces, which are their little ways of understanding and relating to creation. And so, you know, thinking about the ultimate true fae, you know, which you really only find in changeling in the deep, 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 deep dreaming, as being that kind of wildly unfocused, glamorous potential, I think helps put a lot of shape on things. It helps bring what glamour and the dreaming and all of that was supposed to be into focus for me. The dreaming made a lot more sense after I read Graceful Wicked, actually, in a lot of ways. At least what they meant things. I wouldn't say it made the game easier to play, but I understood the intent of the developers better.
The other thing that I noticed just going back and reading old Changeling stuff for this was they describe freeholds in Changeling in a very similar relationship as the shaped and unshaped in Wicked Masks. They specifically say that a freehold, which in Changeling is the power center of their society, it's their cairn, it's their node. It's a protrusion of the dreaming into the real world, sure. It's also a protrusion of the real world into the dreaming. And they give a couple of paragraphs to talking about how the real world around a freehold becomes a little strange. Normal, good people may be inclined to avoid it. Likewise, the dreaming around the dreaming side of a freehold becomes much more orderly, comprehensible, and there are kinds of chimera who will avoid that environment. And so, talking about freeholds, we come to different ways to collect glamour. Because one of the main benefits of a freehold is because it's such a strong resonance with the dreaming, any changeling who sleeps in the presence of the freehold's balefire regains a certain number of points of glamour, having done nothing in particular other than sleep. The other ways changelings recover glamour are interesting, because a lot of them highlight glamour's slightly detrimental aspects. The basic ways of collecting glamour for the Cathayne, there are a couple different for the Glane, but we'll get into those later. The different methods of collecting glamour are you can find someone who has potential as an artist or an inventor, somebody who has a natural affinity for the dreaming, and you can cultivate that affinity in a process called reverie, where your character and that NPC, usually, form a bond, and your character mentors them in their craft, allowing them to achieve ever higher expressions of their potential, their glamorous connection to the dreaming. This is a process that takes a while and has a lot of pitfalls. The more common method of collecting glamour, at least until the Shi come back, and probably after the Shi come back if you don't ask the Shi, is ravaging, where you find somebody who has this instinctual connection to the dreaming, and you commit psychological warfare against them in some way or another, and essentially you just tear that energy out of them, which has some fairly negative repercussions. Then there's Rhapsody, where it's ravaging on steroids. And there's also Rapture, where because changelings are part human, they, if they cultivate their human side, can achieve their own connection to the dreaming in a way that is both like and unlike humans' connection to the dreaming, and they can produce their own glamour. This is, at least in the system, the most difficult way to collect glamour. And then there's also collecting glamour from dross, which is changelings' solidified mystical energy stuff that every World of Darkness game has, I think. And dross takes a lot of weird forms. It can be someone's angsty teenage poetry. It could be the Mona Lisa. It could be a dead chimera. And most of the time, if you're going to use the energy in dross, you have to either consume it somehow or destroy it in an appropriate manner for your use.
The thing that I find kind of interesting about all of these is that in their own ways, they all represent the loss of potential. They represent the Fae feeding on the possibility of what that creativity could have become. Even musing, you're spending all this time and you're cultivating all this creativity, and it's presented as you just sup a little bit off the top. And it is, in its own way, I mean, it is definitely the kindest, gentlest form of feeding, but it takes so much time, and it does cultivate this person into a really dependent relationship with you. And the thing that struck me that would be really interesting, we talked in a previous episode about what happens when your changeling character goes into brief banality comas. They die, they go through chimerical death, it's temporary, but the period where they're dead is really unsettling and unpleasant for the people who are close to them and have these shared experiences that now they don't remember. And it's one thing for another changeling who knows what's going on. The Changeling 20th Anthology recently came out, and one of the books is about a childer experiencing that for the first time. Not themselves going through chimerical death, but seeing an adult changeling go through chimerical death for the first time and experiencing that rejection of, no, none of what we just did happened. And it's a really lighthearted, fun adventure until the end. But the thing about musing is, because you're spending all this time in developing this relationship, what does that do to the human when you go into chimerical death? As traumatizing as it is for other changelings, they at least have context once they've been through it once or twice, but a dreamer doesn't. And now you can't enchant them. They become addicted to your glamour, and you're off the map for who knows how long. It creates this very dependent, toxic, addicted relationship, which is something that I'd like to see developed more. It's an aspect of musing that I think would give a different sheen to some of the Sealy.
And in our games, I've been running that if anybody ever actually got around to musing more than once, they might end up accidentally teaching a human being, a mortal, how to contact the dreaming on their own, therefore being able to see chimerical reality. And what do you do with that person is a question I'd really like the players to get to, but we haven't ever gotten there yet.
I mean, players, you can't have strong plans for your chronicle. You'll never reach them.
Right, but even in that case, you end up with somebody who, if they're lucky, they have the force of, you know, tradition and story behind them, and they're able to reframe their new world. But for the majority of modern humans, that wouldn't be there. And the only person, like, if you've been in a mentoring relationship, you have this huge problem where your foundational reality has changed. Who do you go to?
You go to your mentor.
Right. And what happens then? Because telling mortals about chimerical reality, the Fae, is a violation of the Escheat, their code
yep.
of conduct, and at the same time, leaving that poor person wandering around to be treated by the world as if they're mad is a violation of a lot of other things.
Although, to be fair about the Escheat, I mean, I was watching a presentation from Sarah RP on YouTube. She has a very, very large Changeling channel because she runs a public online Changeling forum. She runs a game that's part of a larger setting, and she talked about they had a character that broke this part of the Escheat. And they had to do so many backflips and so many things to get past the mists, which is supposed to be impossible. She didn't reveal in the video what exactly this character did, but all the storytellers in this group setting got together and talked through it and went, yeah, that would do it. I'm sure part of why she didn't share it is some people would probably disagree with her, but narratively it made sense and was compelling. It's really hard to break that part of the Escheat, because it's like, oh, yeah, changelings exist. Look at all these chimera. Oh, your enchantment's worn off. No, you're fine. You're just late for class. Go on. I mean...
yeah, and the other really creepy thing you run into is, in the enchantment rules, a point of... You spend glamour to enchant somebody, and if you do it in a particular way, it lasts a little bit longer than it would otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But every time you enchant somebody, you're spending glamour, which is fairly rare resource in most games.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to get glamour than it is to get Gnosis or Blood or Quintessence or Pathos. Glamour
right,
is expensive.
Right, and part of that is, part of the reason for that is if you're using chimerical only cantrips, you're only affecting chimerical reality, they're free.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of, like, the action in a changeling game is going to be between chimerical things and other chimerical things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, very rarely you're going to need to heal a mortal wound, which, yeah, that'll cost you a point of glamour. But other than that, the thing is so you're spending that glamour to enchant a mortal. If you enchant them in a freehold, it lasts a week or until they leave the freehold. And then you end up with this really weird dynamic where you have this kept artist.
Yep.
And it's
well,
encouraging that toxicity.
Kept artist or kept other creature, human creature of potential. In the con game I ran in 1925, I turned the Green Mill in Chicago into a freehold, which totally makes sense, and I put a Boggin in control. And part of what the changelings of Chicago at that time did to keep the peace and keep the other, honestly, much more dangerous supernaturals from destroying them is they regularly enchanted and addicted key people, including, for anyone who knows history of Chicago, the Green Mill, it was Al Capone's favorite hangout. And so but when you were in the Green Mill, you didn't get into fights. Like, you could have Northside gangers in there with Capone and outfit gangers. And they might shoot each other up as soon as they're out of Uptown, but they would not get into a fight in the Green Mill, by and large, mostly. I mean, there were exceptions, but it was mostly a no-fire zone. Because if you can't go and have a good time and listen to some jazz and do some dancing, there was a ballroom right down the street from the Green Mill called, delightfully, the Arcadia Ballroom. You know, what's the point of all the riches of this mob world? But I set it up as the head of the Changeling in Chicago ran the Green Mill. That was a freehold. And every time Al came in, he enchanted him. And so while he was there, having a great time, seeing everything for what it was, having all his memories of his previous enchantments, no, I want this to last. And it kept him docile. It kept him in a space where he didn't want everything to explode. But then he'd go out, and this whole like prohibition cycle and his relationship to things he associated with the Green Mill was incredibly damaging and destructive. And he brought potential into the world. He manifested it in amazing, terrifying ways. But hey, the changelings were safe. So, you know, there's a lot of potential. It's addiction. It's addiction dynamic. And that's what it always turns into with enchantment.
And talking about addiction, the easier way of collecting glamour that is frowned upon in polite society is ravaging. And that, we touched on earlier, is a kind of psychic assault. It's a little bit hard to characterize because it's a personal experience for most people. And you have to have a level of empathy to be able to enact a ravaging. You have to be able to tell what is going to destroy a person. But at the same time, some of the thresholds for ravaging aren't necessarily... they're destructive at their core, but they don't necessarily have to have a negative impact on the person you're ravaging. Mm-hmm. Because ravaging is removing the potential to feel a particular way or to have a particular inspirational thought. The easiest way to explain it is the changeling is taking all of their personal banality and forcing it into their victim, which then leaves no room for whatever glamour they might have had. And the changeling then collects it. And because this is a metaphor for removing somebody's ability to feel in some particular way, a lot of the examples are destroying somebody by making them believe you love them and then breaking their heart. And then it gets weird because then it gets into making somebody enraged.
Yeah, so, and this is something we've talked about, is clearly what they designed with musing and ravaging is the good, responsible, happy way to collect glamour, and ravaging is the bad, naughty, unseelie way to collect glamour. And that's clearly what it was in First Ed. It's not interesting, and it doesn't actually end up making a ton of sense. So this idea of you could muse anger, you could inspire rage, you could inspire hatred, and slowly develop it. And sure, those things will push out other emotions, but I think musing should do that. If you're musing an artist, they will become completely obsessively focused on whatever you're inspiring in them, and other things will fall aside. They will disappear, they will stop eating, they will stop drinking, they will stop paying attention to their lover. And anyone who has ever known an artist knows exactly how that would play out in game. So the idea that if you mused rage and hatred, it would knock out these other things that somehow makes it not musing. No, that would still be musing, but that's not how it's written. Like, musing hate would be viewed as ravaging, when I don't necessarily think that it should be. I think the idea that I am shoving this banality into you, pushing out your potential to feel, and then sucking all of that up and using it for myself as the predator that I am, I think is a lot more compelling. I have actually seen a much more nuanced use of ravaging in the Changeling canon. I just read it recently, so it's part of why I'm invoking it so much, but there's a story in the Changeling 20th anthology that just really kind of, it rent at my gut, because it's an entire story about abuse. There are these two changelings who are siblings, and it's a story about them dealing with their abusive father. And the way one of them dealt with their abusive father, and warning, this is a spoiler, so if you want, still want to read that anthology and you care, skip the next 30 seconds, minute, or whatever. She had been repeatedly ravaging her father because if she ravaged her father, he lost all of his impetus. He lost his potential to be an abusive bastard. And what it turned into is this cycle of self-hatred because she had done that for so long and it eventually killed him. But she had all of that glamour that she had ravaged out of him in herself, and she was convinced that he had tainted her. And so it's this whole story about her and her sibling that didn't know she'd been doing this and discovered it and was also a changeling coping with this and where she'd, you know, how she had dealt with that. And I thought that was a brilliant way to deal with an express ravaging because it really paints it in a different light. Like, it's not, I'm not some horrible shadow court monster ravaging you in the night. I totally get where she's coming from and why it's toxic and terrible, both for her father and for her, even though it displaced this abuse in a not productive way, you know. So I thought that was a pretty brilliant use of ravaging.
I really like that because one of the things that annoys me that people tend to forget about abusive relationships is that rarely is the abuse completely one-sided. It can be predominantly one-sided most of the time, but you end up in really unhealthy, well, unhealthy relationship with somebody, and you can abuse them back. You might still be the victim most of the time, but it's a complicated, messy situation, and the things you do to survive are not the same things you would do in ideal circumstances.
No, and it evokes a lot of themes of self-preservation and of self-loathing because you then have to deal with the fact that you're capable of those things you did to survive. And, you know, broadly, I don't see a lot of stories that deal with that aspect of abuse very well. I can think of one, it's totally off topic, but I liked that that showed up in one of the stories in this Changeling anthology because it definitely has a place central to what Changeling is.
The other thing about ravaging is that in both Dark Ages Fae and in Wicked Masks, and it's implied in Dreaming, although I don't think it's ever outright stated, for the majority of their history, the Fae survived by ravaging. They didn't do anything else. This musing thing is a modern invention to most Fae. They've just forgotten, thanks to the mists.
Which, if you think about it, makes a lot of sense because if you think about Fae in myths, they didn't have any empathy for humans. They weren't necessarily monsters. There were Fae that, if you gave them the right offering and you were kind to them, they would be kind back. They'd do a good turn, but it wasn't because they felt for you. It was because, well, I'm going to fulfill my obligations and do a good turn because we made an agreement and they were driven by rules.
Right, until
And
they
yeah.
started inhabiting humans, their
Exactly.
relationship with reality was primarily, if not exclusively, transactional.
Yep. Exactly. And that's, you know, that's something about that I like about Changeling the Dreaming as opposed to a lot of other modern takes on the Fae, is a lot of other modern takes on the Fae go for this child snatching, traumatic alien other from beyond space and time that really, if you go back and look at the relationship that we'll say the Milesians, the various peoples that engaged with the Fae, the Milesians refers to a specific myth in Ireland, but that idea of the humans that had this relationship with the fair folk, you know, before Christianity showed up, they were kind of godlike, and they had this terrified and yet also productive relationship with them, and then along comes a spider named Christianity and tries to turn them into demons, as they did with a lot of other religions. And then you end up with this much more, we're always ravaging, we're always taking, come baptize your changeling child. And I see that version of the Fae represented a lot. And part of what I like about the whole messy glamour relationship is it, and the whole story from the fair folk, which are pretty alien, horrible, awful things through the Dark Ages Fae, where they have these oaths with humanity and they have relationships and it's become more transactional, down to changelings, where you're on this constant knife's edge, and off one side is your humanity and off the other side is this archetypical thing you are, and having to negotiate both of that. It's much more of that messy, dangerous, kind of productive, kind of potential, kind of toxic soup that I see in a lot of the pre-Christian relationships with Fae. And I like how that plays out. And I think glamour represents a lot of that.
I enjoyed the Greek relationship, the Greek relationship with the Dodecatheon, their pagan pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't view the people the gods favored as lucky. They generally thought of the people who the gods interfered with as being pretty unlucky.
You know, it's funny that you say that. There's this story that my mother told from when I was born. She had a friend who was from Greece, and I was a baby, and she, like, showed me to this friend of hers. And this friend looked at me and then looked at my mother and shook her head and said, "What a homely child." And then sort of, like, winked and said, "Now, you must know, if you have a child and you praise them too highly and you say they are too beautiful, the gods may grow jealous and interfere in their life." And then looked at me again and went, "What a homely child." And it was just such an incredibly Greek compliment. And it was so fantastic. And it, your story about their relationship with their gods made me think of that.
And then we have the people who the Fae take particular interest in and become victims of rhapsody.
Oh, yes.
Which, we've brought it up before. There's a beautiful scene in Chrysalis, which is a webcomic that died, I think. But it was a Changeling the Dreaming webcomic. There's a scene in it that portrays a rhapsody where a she, it's not explained who, but a she rhapsodizes a mortal, and they produce this incredible masterpiece-level sculpture that the she then smashes to bits in front of them and encourages the artist to commit suicide because they'll never produce anything with any feeling ever again. Mwahahahaha.
Yes, and that she was very clearly house... Is it Leonin, I believe? That is addicted...
Leonhan, but...
Leonhan. And they're addicted to rhapsody, and they have to do it once a week. And I remember reading that and just thinking, there's no way. There's once a week? And this induces suicide? And the only give there is that you can do rhapsody as a group because it produces so much glamour. And you're not just pushing out, you know, a human's ability to feel emotion for a week or so, which is what a normal ravaging does. You know, repeated ravaging might leave them numb for much longer, but one ravaging, they're not going to feel whatever emotion you push out of them for a while, but they'll get over it. No, you've pushed out all of their potential to ever produce ever again. So, I mean, it does give an amount of glamour commensurate with that sacrifice. And so, like, five or six of these she who have to perform this act once a week or age out of existence, they can share a dreamer. But still, once a week. I mean...
Right. And system-wise, just for the nitty-gritty, it's the... basically the total reverse of a ravaging. So each of the participants in a rhapsody is contributing at least one, or more than one, point of glamour, and they're pumping that into the dreamer, the artist, the inventor, whoever, and they're essentially using it as a way to make the dreamer into a jump spark between the real world and the dreaming, and all of the potential that they might have had for the rest of their life comes through that one lightning stroke of inspiration.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic plot hook. I love it as a thing that almost never happens, so that if you find someone doing it, you really have to invest a lot of time in it. You can get caught. It can be interrupted. I think it's a fantastic bit for the storyteller. If I ever had a player try to do a rhapsody, I would sort of treat it like a vampire player asking me if they could play a Bali, or a mage player being, can I play a Nefandi? And I'd be like, no. No, you can't.
Yeah, it gets into my pet theory about the developers being conflicted about whether the Shi were player characters or not. Because a lot of the Shi stuff is really cool player character material, and then a lot of the Shi stuff is, that's a place I don't want to go. Back to Rapture, which is the method of creating glamour that is entirely introspective and a complete modern innovation for the changelings, because until they took on a human body, they couldn't even conceive of this idea. With Rapture, they're essentially musing or using reverie on themselves, and it's an incredibly difficult process because, one, you have to already be a reasonably skilled artist, craftsman, whatever. And then you have to have that degree of separation from your own work to be able to step back, look at it, and mentor yourself in it, which is a thing none of my players have ever used, which says a lot about how smart they are in recognizing how tough it is.
Yeah, there's this actually kind of leads into the final way of harvesting dross, going back to that Chrysalis webcomic. There was an interesting scene where two of the characters were interacting, and it was a transactional kind of thing. There was a slua there. It was like, I need some glamour. I need glamour if you want me to do this thing for you. And the satyr said, well, I have some dross, which is physical distilled glamour in the form of a piece of art or work. And he hands it over, and the slua says, oh, well, I mean, angsty teenage poetry isn't normally my thing, but I guess it'll work. And the satyr goes, those are mine. And it's interesting because he's clearly not a teenager. He's clearly older. And not grump, but solid college, like past what it's referenced as. And it always struck me that he created this glamour, but maybe he can't use it. Whether it's because he can't bring himself to destroy his own work, or this kind of division you're talking about. I find the idea of Rapture as a source of glamour, but maybe not for you, to be really interesting.
Right, and in our game, we've actually started differentiating between when you create glamour, what is it exactly you've created? Because we're going forward with the idea that you're really interested in that pause, the potential of a thing to exist rather than the thing existing itself. And a lot of the different changeling methods of creating glamour, musing, rapture, some of the Nunahi methods, lend themselves to creating dross, but it's never actually said that these create dross. It's just that you get glamour out of it, or medicine in the case of the Nunahi. And so we've developed the idea that for reverie, what you've done is you've inspired this human, they've created this work of art, and it's not that you're just picking up dregs from around them, it's that after they're done, or while they're doing it, you're making off with a paintbrush that got infused with a bit of chimerical reality, or you're taking a prototype that didn't work, but it didn't work because it wasn't a perfect ideation of what they were trying to do. It's not that it is junk, it's just that it's imbued with a kind of not completeness to it. And you're destroying those things instead of destroying their art like you do with Rhapsody.
I really like that, not just because it gives you a better way to roleplay what you're doing, it gives the human a chance to find you and stop you, which I think gives hunting a little bit of an edge. It also takes away something that at the very least might be emotionally precious to the artist, and so it gives more of a concrete sense to what you're taking when you're musing, but also it's very fae. Like, that just makes me think about fairy tales and brownies and the things they make off with and their trophies and the shiny things. It's fae in a way that Changeling the Dreaming a lot of times isn't. I really like that.
There was a lovely Charles Dillon story that I'm not going to remember the name of anymore, but it's about a woman who owns a bookshop and she's just a huge mess. She runs the bookshop. She's a lovely person. She can't run a business to save her life. But she's attracted a brownie, and the brownie keeps her shop organized for her and, like, unloads shipments that she forgets about and packs
such
bargain. And, yeah. And at night, or rather during the day, when it can't work because she's around, it retreats into its little hole in the wall or wherever it was staying with some of her books. The ones it thinks she'll never miss. And invariably, they're the ones that she was going to give to a customer that were special orders.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I love that as inspiration, and I definitely want to use that for future musings. I mean, I could see scenarios where you wouldn't necessarily take a physical thing if you're a Fiona She and you're musing through sex and whatnot. There are other symbolic things that invoke fairy tales of what you're taking, especially if we're talking about sex, that still hold that place. But I like the narrative bow that puts on the experience, whereas before it was kind of ambiguous.
Right. And with Dross, they always made the distinction that Dross ought to be appropriate to the use you're putting it to. So if you're using Dross to power a healing cantrip, if you're using Dross to power Heather Balm, you want to take Dross that was gathered gently, or Dross that was gathered from an inspirational act, or from actual Heather. And It gives you a bonus to your roll, where if you try to power that with Dross that you stole from somebody, or Dross that reflects decay, it's not going to work as well for the cantrip.
Yeah, and that makes total sense. One thing I think we should spend a little bit of time on before sort of moving into banality in more detail is some of the versions of potential that aren't glamour. Most of what we talked about is this creative dynamic and art and paintbrushes and, you know, destroying a work of art. But most of the player classes in Changeling actually aren't the core Kith. The Hisien have almost as many or possibly as many groups as the Kithane. The Nunahi have more. And then you have the Inanime and the Adheen. And they all get their potential differently, and it's not tied to creativity necessarily, although a lot of them are tied to potential. And so, you know, it's worth talking about how that differs. And by and large, they all have similar corollaries to the musing ravaging kind of situation, although not in all cases. The Nunahi probably come the closest. And I'll let Simon talk about how the Nunahi gather medicine, because they have medicine instead of glamour. He's used them in game more than I have.
So the Nunahi underwent a changeling ritual similar to the commoners, because they still reincarnate the way the commoners do. It's pretty strongly implied that most of the underpinnings are the same. They found particularly spiritually adept or sensitive human beings in their cultures and said, hey, let's make a pact. Your firstborn child, or your third child, or whatever is the particularly lucky number for that culture, is going to be the host of our child. And it's not outright stated, but pretty strongly implied that they haven't displaced a human soul in creating a changeling the way the Shi do, that they've either fused with or somehow attached themselves to a human soul through this practice, and created a changeling that's basically the same as the Kithane, just with different cultural underpinnings. And they power all of their magic and their being through medicine, which isn't an appropriate term for all of the Native American groups, but it's what they picked for the game, so it's what we're going with. And they, in the fiction and canon, have lost their connection to the dreaming, mostly due to the genocide against the Native Americans perpetrated by the European settlers. And so they find it exceptionally difficult to collect medicine. They find it exceptionally difficult to collect medicine from human creativity unless it's from expression that is particularly tied to the culture they're from. But their cultures are all the victims of genocide, so they are few. And so they've developed this other method of collecting medicine, where they bond with the land, and they have a reverie ravaging mechanism there, where they will either try to commune with the land and make it healthier, their version of reverie, or they are in a big fat hurry and they just tear medicine out of it, which damages the land. It's not like outright stated that this is the same thing as a, you know, development and pollution, but it's kind of there. And that gets a little problematic because Native Americans aren't like Stone Age people who never built anything and didn't develop complex societies and technologies and trade routes, and they cultivated the land in ways that would not have left it pristine, but that's a different topic, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, but to be fair, I don't think it's a different topic, because the other aspect of harvesting medicine is it has to be from pristine, untouched land, which totally gets into lovely white stereotypes about Native peoples, because you go back and you study the tribes of the Mississippi Valley, which goes far beyond what we think of as the state of Mississippi, but I believe the state of Mississippi was part of it, and they were completely agricultural. They had villages. They had major settlements. They cultivated the land, and they cultivated it quite impressively. You go out into the Southwest, and there were cities that were built up in the desert. That's not untouched land. It's a very weird relationship, and it's built on, I feel like it's built more on the whole modernity is evil theme that's central to the world of darkness, and being like, ooh, an opportunity to tap that, as opposed to really being a great dynamic for Native American fairy tale stories.
The Nunahi gather medicine from pristine land, which puts them at a pretty serious disadvantage because there's not a whole lot of that in a typical changeling game.
There's not. It's, I almost feel like if you use the system as written, you really have to make a game entirely about the Nunahi. There isn't a lot of space for a mixed game. I think if you loosen the requirements on that a fair bit, if you say somewhere like Central Park in New York or out by the lake in Chicago maybe has a higher difficulty of getting medicine, but it's still possible, then you could have a Nunahi character in that setting. It would be possible to put them there, but I really feel like you do need to change it a little bit, which is, you know, I think worth doing. It's worth telling stories where multiple cultures in the U.S. are represented. And again, you know, the numbers, Native American population numbers are quite low, but I have friends who are Native American and who take part in the culture and live in cities. And I, you know, want to be able to bring them into my games and have them be able to play a reflection of themselves. We all like playing reflections of ourselves. So I think changing some of those medicine dynamics to make that viable is really worth doing.
Right. And just for context, I live in a city that has a res in the middle of it, and we have a very contentious relationship between the vast majority of people and the Native Americans here. We pretend we don't, but we do. And this has come to a head over the name of a lake near here, formerly Lake Calhoun, which was named after a Civil War general who was a flaming racist. It has been changed to Lake Calhoun / Bibimakaska, one of the earlier names for the lake, which is, I'm told, Dakota for Lake of White Sands or something like that, which honestly is a much nicer name than Lake Calhoun, but the parks board in this city, one of the top objectives the people who vote for the parks board came up with was to change the name from Calhoun to Bidimakaska. And it's the only thing the parks board has absolutely refused to act on that whole list. So there's a really good place in Changeling for this kind of a story, if Changeling is, like the rest of the World of Darkness, supposed to be a take on the bullshit we get into in the real world.
Yeah, there really is, and wanting to tell that kind of story, there's a lot of potential there related to people. And so also maybe loosening the glamour harvesting from people dynamics from the Nunahi and opening up musing and ravaging and arguably even rhapsody. You know, there's a certain dark story there that I would want to necessarily avoid for myself, but I would engage with that story if told by a native storyteller. I think it just opens up a lot of potential that the Nunahi could definitely use.
Right, and even the Kithain would benefit from having a different relationship to the land, because, like the Shi, they are of the land. Brownies are of the place they're from. Puka are river spirits. Like, if we get into this, and we want to engage with the source material a little bit more than we already do, opening that door makes a lot of sense for the game itself.
It does, which actually also kind of leads into the way another group of Galain harvest glamour, the Hisien. And the Hisien, and I have to admit to having not read all of their glamour, well, they don't have glamour, they have chi, but I haven't read those rules incredibly recently, but they gather their energy through dragon nests. So basically, again, that connection of the land. Dragon nests in World of Darkness are basically nodes, and they're connected by dragon lines, if you're looking at the Eastern books, but ley lines. They gather glamour that way, but they also glamour it through answering prayers. The god relationship between the Fae and humans is very explicit with the Hisien. And it's interesting, if you step back and look at the three main groups, the Kith have the whole trickster, dark, fairy, feeding on humanity dynamic that developed because of the Christian relationship with, you know, the animist faiths in the Isles. And then the Nunahi have this of-the-land animist element, which was also in the Isles, but didn't get expressed in the Kith as much. And then the Hisien have the we-are-diminished-gods dynamic, when really all three of those groups should have all three of those aspects. And so I always thought it would be really interesting, especially with the Nunahi, because, you know, they're still active living religions and people that actively believe that Nunahi, the people that live everywhere, really exist. It was dealt with in the book that I read where it talked about if you ask a member of one of the tribes where that myth came from, do you believe in the Nunahi? They basically look at you and are like, yeah, I'm not answering that question. You're not in my tribe. We're not having this conversation. But that in and of itself is its own sort of answer. And so, you know, taking that, oh, these entities are still worshipped, shouldn't worship be a part of this? But the Hisien get that. It's interesting in that that's part of how they gather their, I'm just going to say glamour. I hate saying chi for the Fae, any Fae from any culture. It's so weird because the chi is something very specific. And yeah, so I will leave that statement where it is.
Right. And it's worth mentioning that in the precursor games, Dark Ages Fae and Wicked Masks, which is, in my opinion, a storyteller book, not a player book, but
absolutely,
they have different energies. In Dark Ages Fae, you collect mists and weaving energy. Weaving is not particularly well used, which I thought was odd, but mists powers everything. It's the clear glamour analog for the most part. You use it to power your cantrips, you use it to power basically anything you do. I'm trying to think of something that uses weaving explicitly, and I can't think of anything. But
and yet they are points you can spend.
Yes.
It's very odd.
And in Wicked Masks, they use essence like everybody else. They also collect gossamer, which is supposed to be glamour, I think. It's glamour weaving-ish. It's something that you can find in humans. It's also something you can find in the parts of the wild that touch the real world, although most shaped fair folk won't do that because going out of the real world is somewhat suicidal for them. But Gossamer, it's implied, is the thing that shaped a chunk of the wild into the dreaming. It's not outright stated, but if you read between the lines, it's there.
And it makes sense because the way Gossamer is described is that it is what's necessary to make any of the wild things the Fae create permanent. So it kind of makes sense that it would reduce the wild from this completely chaotic place that it is in the Mythic Age down to something that is still pretty malleable and pretty dangerous and pretty chaotic, but even the darkest corners of the dreaming are still described in terms of the deepest parts of the human psyche. And as long as you're still sort of correlating to the deepest, most disturbingly chaotic parts of dreams and using that as the invocation point, you're still dealing with a thing that exists that we have experiential context for. As opposed to wild, which was really, we're not going to spend too many words describing this because we want it to literally be ineffable. And if it's ineffable, we can't describe it with words because those have structure. Thanks. I mean, so I think Gossamer does make sense in that way. But again, it's a very different sort of relationship. And you can kind of see how it turns into mists, maybe even weaving, and then turns into glamour. But yeah, it's another one of those early books are great for kind of getting a sense for what did they really think the Fae were? What were they trying to capture? But they aren't necessarily good books to pull system or structural things from.
My phone chimes. It's Steve. He's back from break with his family. I can't wait to tell him what happened in court while he was gone. It was an epic summer. He's living off campus now, and I thought that was going to be awesome. I'm standing on his stoop, waiting for him to answer the door, and I can tell something's wrong. When the door opens, I see what it is. His face. The spirals on his cheeks that glow a deep candy cane crimson when he works are gray and dull. His seeming is there, kind of, but I wish it wasn't. The mists are kinder than whatever I'm looking at. He's happy to see me, but everything is wrong, and I don't understand what's happening. We go downstairs into his workshop, and it's immaculate? No knocker has an immaculate workshop. He's building something, and sits down to start working on it again, as if I'm not even there. I watch him counting holes and rows on a prototype circuit board over and over. He's counting exactly 3 times before putting his circuits in. I uncomfortably lean over to him and joke. Whatever happened to the kid who always knew where to put the wire? He looks up at me and smiles. Yeah, I was a pretty sloppy kid, wasn't I? But after the work I did for my dad this summer, I know that if it isn't perfect, it isn't worth making. Right? So the other, I guess you can't really call it a power trait, but it acts like one a lot of the time for Changeling is banality. And banality is variably described as the power of disbelief, the power of habits and things that disconnect you from feeling, the power of a lot of really unhealthy things in the modern world, I suppose.
The thing about banality is, I kind of feel like banality is actually the ultimate climax of the story they started telling with Werewolf. Vampire is its own standalone urban thing, but they started telling this story about fear of death, the horrors of the modern world, the horrors of never being willing to give up anything. And part of never being willing to give up anything is if you've, and we've all known these people, maybe some of us are these people, and maybe we do or maybe we don't acknowledge that about ourselves. But when you meet people that have filled their lives to the brim, either scheduling, they filled their lives to the brim, or their house, there isn't an inch to move in because they can't, I might need that thing. I don't want to let that go. Fear of missing out. They've left no potential in their life. There is no potential energy left in their life at all. And banality is kind of that in a lot of ways to me. You know, it's expressed in the Early Autumn People book as kind of all the constructs of modern white collar work, counting things over and over, doing data entry, doing these mundane, boring tasks that you've been told have value, but deep in your heart, you don't really think they have value, and they suck up all your time, so they suck up all your potential. And then you come home and you're exhausted, and so the potential of your evening is gone. And truth be told, anyone who's ever had a 9-to-5 job, and even a lot of people that have had more dynamic jobs, they know that feeling. They know that emptiness. And, you know, if you're lucky, that emptiness is just, okay, I'm staying in and throwing on a TV series and ordering pizza tonight, and that's my evening. And yeah, nobody dies and says, ooh, I spent, you know, 5,000 nights doing that. I'm satisfied. But you do it anyway because it's what you have to give to reality at that moment in time. And banality is that, and the Fae hate that.
Right. I was babysitting one of my friend's kids a while back, and we were out for a walk around their neighborhood, and she picked up a walk trophy. It was a stick, and she was waving it around like it was a magic wand, and it was all terribly cute. And she stuck it through her little paper crown thing she'd made earlier that day, and she'd been wearing around. And she said, "Yow!" And I said, "Well, what happened?" And she said, "I stabbed my crown." And I looked, and it had passed through a hole in her crown, and it hadn't made the hole, it was just a hole. And I pulled it out, and I said, "No, see, everything's fine. If you take it off, you can look at it. It didn't tear it at all." And she said, "Yeah, but that hole was part of the crown." And it was one of those moments for me where it's a bit of thing from the Tao Te Ching. I don't remember which part particularly, but there's a whole discussion and meditation on how the useful part of an object isn't necessarily its structure, it's its emptiness. A house that you can't enter is useless. A vase that can't hold water is useless. And it was just very, very changeling-esque for me to have that particular truth pointed out to me by somebody who was two at the time.
That is so incredibly changeling, and I absolutely love that. You know, and it's funny, honestly, the description of the completely full life actually really only came to me here as I was talking about it. And I think it's because we talked so much about glamour as potential, but and filling someone up with banality is ravaging, but banality really is kind of the power of lost potential. And that even has a power, you know, the people you know that fill their schedules up, and I was totally in that place just 2 weeks ago. I just finished a move. I just ended an almost 2-year-long chronicle. I stepped out of another chronicle I was playing in because I went, I need time. I need potential back in my life. I, you know, just kind of got over a hump in a new job that I started a few months ago, and now it's kind of sinking, and so it's not taking up so much of my psychic energy outside of the actual hours I spend doing it. All those things are coming together. And it's interesting being at this place where, like, wow, I have potential again. And I actually don't really know how to leverage it. Like, at this moment in time, I have more time and I know that. I'm not fighting with this closing and everything else, but I don't really know how to make use of it. I'm not able to do more than I could do a few weeks ago. And mentally, I know it's going to take a month or two of readjusting and just standing there with the potential around me, that space and breathing in it. But there's still part of me that's like, no, but I should have the, I can do this now, right? I can fill it up again. And again, that's kind of banality and it's powerful. Like when it, I got a lot done with all of that, but I couldn't get anything done with all of that there. And so banality is this weird, it can be both of those things. You can use it to resist a cantrip, although that's dangerous. You can, it's what grounds you against bedlam, but you don't want it to get out of control. So it's interesting, although it's usually presented as negative. You look closely, kind of like glamour, it's usually presented as positive, but you look closely and it's not always.
Mm-hmm. Like with the freehold thing, the dreaming needs some structure in order to persist, and it can't get it from itself. The thing is banality, more than anything else, represents a toxic level of weaving. It's, like you said, creating so much structure that there's no space for anything useful to happen, anything spontaneous. And that structure is really useful. It's, in Dark Ages Fae, it's what makes cantrips work at all. But at the same time, you need, for an object to be useful, it has to have both structure and a capacity to be used, to be filled with something. And for the Fae, that death of spontaneity is absolutely the anathema for them. It just completely destroys them.
Yeah, it really does, and it, I feel like, speaks to an experience that we all have as people as we grow up, and so much of Changeling is a growing up story, is when we're young, anything is possible. There are all of these possibilities, all of this potential, but our ability to actually give form to any of it is really limited. And then, you know, now I'm 35, and there are so many things I tried when I was in college or I was in high school, and some of them I'm going back and making another attempt at, and it is so much better because I am more skilled, but more importantly, I'm more disciplined. I have all of the traits of banality that allow me to focus in on a thing and not be distracted and not sort of spin up something and go, oh, it's beautiful, it's magnificent, I'm done, and just move on because I have the focus to look at it and go, this is a first draft, and now I'm actually going to do editing. Because college students end the night before paper and, oh, it'll be fine, and then you're like, you hit 30-something and you're like, it wasn't fine. It's never been fine. That's banality. But at the same time, and again, going back to the whole artist dilemma dynamic, you need that to persist as an artist, to create amazing things. You have all of these ideas, going back to that kind of Kabbalistic concept. Banality is what drags something down from one world into the next. And if it lives up in those top two worlds forever, who cares? You want it to come down into the third world where you can talk to someone else about it, and maybe it becomes an ephemera up in their first world. You want to drag it down into reality and have this beautiful thing you've created. And you have to have enough focus and dedication and ability to shove out other possibilities because, no, I want this thing to be the possibility, to give it form. I think the perfect kind of kernel of that in a Changeling book is in a text that overall I don't totally love, but in Denizens of the Dreaming, they talk about the Adhene. And the Adhene are true fae that still live in the Dreaming. And they're not changelings, they can't take form, they can kind of do short, violent spurts of possession and influence the real world, but they can't live there. And it talks about the effects of banality on them, and the effects of banality just ravage them. It makes what banality does to the she look quaint, but it does say even an Adhene in the deepest, deepest parts of the deep dreaming has a little bit of banality, or they wouldn't even be a thing. They wouldn't be what they are. It's just such an infinitesimal amount that for game system purposes, it's zero. But they felt the need to call out that they're a thing with a name and an identity and an idea. They have banality. And I feel like the fact that they felt the need to call that out really illuminates a lot of what banality is supposed to represent.
And when you get into the historical evolution of the Fae, at least in World of Darkness, they start out as the unshaped in Exalted, where nothing exists with any kind of permanence, except sometimes them for a little while. Then reality is created, and the Unshaped continue to exist, but they've noticed this persistence in the wild, and necessarily, having understood it, they've accidentally incorporated some of its concepts, persistence being one of them, and they begin to take on an infectious quality from it, and perhaps they themselves never organize themselves to a level where they're compatible with reality, and a lot of them probably just don't care that much, because caring is a kind of banality. It orders your existence to care about something. And little bits of them maybe start to care about reality more, and they leave the unshaped for shaped existence within reality. They become most of what the fair folk are and exalted. Then into Dark Ages Fae, they've taken a very, very organized shape. They're distinct beings, separate from each other, separate from humanity, mostly separate from the world itself. And they have distinct species, for lack of a better word, splats, where Exalted didn't really have that. They just had, this is your thing, these are your graces, go. And for the Firstborn, the Inanime, and the Changelings, which are different in Dark Ages Fae than they are in Changeling the Dreaming, they're all different sorts of dreaming incursion into the real world. And then the Shattering happens, and they've been forced to either leave, die, or take on a human body. Each one of these steps in the process has been taking on a greater and greater and greater amount of what's in Changeling the Dreaming, banality. They've taken on persistence, name, identity, shape. They've taken on differentiation between each other, differentiation between themselves and the world around them. They've taken on oaths that negotiate their relationships with each other, with the world, with humans, and sort of accidentally they took on echoes and flaws that negotiate their relationship with humans specifically, and then the Shattering, and they took on mortality, which is, for a lot of people, pretty banal, but it's a very limiting concept. And each step of this process has been taking on a greater and greater limitation. So it's hard to look at the thing that came out of all of that, the Changelings, being these sort of, being these brilliant humans that aren't necessarily human, but they're mostly, partly, a little bit human. At the same time, they're a conduit for potential, for glamour, to come into the real world, and it's through the limitations that they're able to be that at all. And viewing banality as purely a bad thing, or purely a sanity system, which it isn't, but
it definitely is not. It's interesting you talk about that arc and how you need banality, and they've, you know, taken a little bit more banality. You know, you go back and look at Dark Ages Fae, and it's likely that the Firstborn, who were really true Fae, eventually become the She, and that the Changelings eventually become the Commoners. Maybe that's not what happened, but I feel like when you talk about the Changeling way and the relationship to humanity, that makes the most sense. And the Changelings in Dark Ages Fae were that very traditional, oh, I'm a Fae who went and was raised by humans, or, oh, I'm a human who was taken away and raised by the Firstborn, or the offspring of, you know, a fair folk and a human that had sex. That sort of intermingling. There's always some form of intermingling and introduction to banality, introduction to solid reality. And then you get forward into Changeling, and there's this group from pretty early first edition called the Shadow Court. And there's a brilliant idea in the Shadow Court. I think maybe I mentioned them in the first episode, about they believe that now at this point they have to wrap themselves deeper and deeper in banality in order to survive the long winter. Most changelings reject banality. They go and they wrap themselves in their freeholds and they hide in front of the balefire, or if they're commoners and they can't get away with that, they throw themselves at dreamers. But then there's the Shadow Court, who says, no, let's go with this. And they never really got developed. There's a Shadow Court book, and the opening fiction is a brilliant expression of that dynamic. And then the rest of the book is Unseelie Love and the Thalane, and it basically turns into a big Unseelie book. It's not terrible as an Unseelie book. It's just not the book it gets advertised as. But it has this brilliant slice of the Shadow Court at the beginning, and then the Shadow Court, that concept is mentioned in the second edition core book. And honestly, and I haven't read all of the setting stuff because I'm not a huge fan of campaign texts, but the Shadow Court doesn't really come up a lot again, ever. But that idea is central to the entire arc of the Fae getting to Changeling the Dreaming, where, okay, crazy unshaped Lord of Chaos, I'm going to create emanations so I can interact with the world but not really go into it. Ooh, the world is interesting and addictive. Well, let's go through this gate. Cool, I'm shaped now. Still crazy Fae. That gate was originally established because I created an oath, which is its own sort of reduction of potential into something else, something specific and concrete, and then becoming the firstborn, and then becoming changelings, or embedding themselves in things and becoming an anime and being tied to a specific element, and then eventually becoming changelings. It's just this over and over. And so the Shadow Court are presented as the ultimate antagonist, except unlike the ultimate antagonist in the other games, nope, that's just what we always do. Except remembrance, so none of us know that. And it's this weird sort of irony. And I want a lot more to be done with that. I've always wanted a lot more to be done with that dynamic in the game, but it hasn't been developed that much.
Yeah, I dig that dynamic. It's interesting because, for the most part, banality is described as being this horrific force that will end you kind of a thing. And that is the case. Banality is a thing that can kill you. So the skepticism about the Shadow Court isn't unfounded, but I've also really enjoyed the idea that the Shadow Court is not necessarily a unified front. I like the idea that the Shadow Court is also kind of being played by Baelor, who have traditional enmity with the greater part of the Cathayn due to how they were created. And maybe part of the reason they back the Shadow Court is because they're trying to get the children of the Tuatha to destroy themselves. Like, that can be a part of their story, too, which I also really enjoy.
Baelor is interesting because it's the only artifact from Changeling that really shows up in Exalted in Graceful Wicked Masks in a kind of coherent way that lines up with what it is in the modern setting. The Balorian Crusade was the first time that the Fair Folk made oaths and were able to take shape in reality. Before that, they'd all been unshaped. They thought creation was this terrible thing because, my wonderful potential is being minimized? No, I would never go into creation. So they were trying to go in and just destroy creation. So they came up with these oaths, and I forget who they convinced, who they tricked into inviting them in through an oath. And this wave of Fair Folk came in just ravaging creation. And they were pushed back by a number of things. And then that's the Balorian Crusade and a whole church. They call it a church, but it's not exactly a religion because everything with the Fair Folk is designed to be an idea, but not the idea you think it is because they're trying to invoke shapelessness around the idea of this Balorian concept. And if you go back and you try to kind of map from Exalted into modern, Baelor maps really nicely. They're the Fae that were born out of this dark, destructive impulse. They're deeply aligned with the Unshaped that hate creation, which in modern Changeling maps really nicely to the Fomorians. But they are shaped. They shaped themselves so they could come into the world and destroy it. And so all of the Fae that trace back to that origin, it makes sense that they would be House Baelor. The dreams that are connected with the memory of this affront onto reality that happened, they really move forward very nicely, and they make a fantastic villain. And it's interesting having them start as hating reality, to come back to the banality theme, and end as kind of playing the Shadow Court. And playing this role and being kind of tied into the Shadow Court, their major emphasis in the Shadow Court book, and they're one of the sections that is a little less purely on Celia and a little more dealing with the Shadow Court, that is suddenly on the other end of that and going, nope, let's wrap ourselves in banality more. Let's cover these trods in chimerical cold iron. Let's really embrace all of these manifestations of this thing we detested earlier. It's interesting, but it's weird and paradoxical in a way that makes sense to me. I don't know if it would make sense to everyone.
House Baelor, at least in my head canon, is probably the most likely of the Kithane to have Duantane amongst them, because they're the ones who would really like to undo quite a lot of things, the Fae among them, but also reality itself. And one of the core themes in World of Darkness generally is that reality is being undone by the influence, the corrupting influence of the worm being conveyed through it by the Weaver's madness. And the Shi are nothing if not great at weaving. And Baelor, with its destructive impulses, brings the worm along for the ride.
Well, and it also makes sense when you think about the worm as it's supposed to be a destroyer. It's supposed to come in and wipe out creation occasionally, not all of creation, but it's supposed to be the purging fire to make space for new things, basically coming in and saying, you're all too banal, you have pushed out too much space, you don't have enough potential, I'm going to come in and just destroy swaths of this. Cool, Wild can come back in and throw some new mists in, and Weaver can come in and do something with it, and it'll be great, and we'll each do our thing, and creation will exist. And any given part of that relationship doesn't necessarily have the big picture view. It's just doing what comes naturally, but that's how Wyrm is supposed to work. But then Wyrm got caught by Weaver and went mad and becomes a corrupter of things instead of a productive destroyer. So if you think about Baelor having started as that, almost, the triad doesn't work quite as perfectly in the exalted setting, but as kind of an expression of that destruction. Yes, they were wild, but it was wild in manifestation of Wyrm, of coming in and just wiping all of that away, and probably serving a productive part of that process. And then you think about what happens cosmologically if it ends up in this place that is represented by the modern relationship between Wyrm and Weaver. And now it's become the corruptor. The Shadow Court framing makes a lot of sense through that lens. It suddenly puts them in a place that fits with the rest of the World of Darkness very neatly. Like, there's a nice little, like, ichor dropping bow on top of that package.
Right. And it's just, it's very tidy. The Shi get into stories of colonialism, of feudal despotism, of really a lot of really, really awful, overly ordered things, and then you drop Baelor into the mix, and you get a really necessary way to reflect on how all of those things, if you put them together and you emphasize them enough, sure, you might get some glamour out of it. It's not the kind you really want.
No, it's really not. But it's something that has to happen. And, you know, we didn't get all of the Unseelie pieces. We didn't get House Baelor and House Leonin in a lot of detail early on in Changeling. But I think they really added a lot of richness and opened up a lot of horror that gives you the ability to kind of merge some of the epic themes with the banality dynamics in really interesting ways. And I think that they also, you know, if you really use them in a nuanced way, I think they're a really fun way to inspect the weird, toxic, necessary, screwy relationship we have as people, because all stories are fundamentally about us, with banality and how necessary it is and how horrible it can be if you let it get out of hand.
The Fae generally have a name-dropped myth about how they're really on Earth in order to achieve a balance between their glamour and their banality. Sort of just shoehorned in there as their Golconda thing, and never really developed, at least not that I ever found. But that's also a thread that you could pull on to make a pretty decent story if you wanted to.
Yeah, that's something I feel like they tried to put in most of the games. I don't know if it really shows up in Werewolf. I mean, you're not really you're a monster in Werewolf, but not a horrible monster. Like, you don't want to not be a werewolf, but Vampire had Golconda, Mage had Ascension front and center, Wraith had Transcendence, and I think I stumbled onto this thing you're talking about, and I remember reading it and thinking, oh, this is just them kind of using the cookie cutter from their other games. I don't like this. Like, there's... It really didn't resonate with me because it's an out for the fundamental nature of their existence. And unlike vampires, where, yeah, okay, Golconda is kind of an out for the fundamental nature of their existence, you really don't necessarily want to be a vampire. You're powerful, but everything else is terrible. Being a changeling is hard and, you know, grueling. But at the same time, it's awesome. It's the thing I love the most about Changeling is that you love what you are. And the horror is of clinging to it like grains of sand slipping through your fingers. But you love what you are in almost like a unhealthy, obsessive way. And so this whole idea of, oh no, I'm going to attain this perfect balance and no longer be this mixture of complicated, messy things. I'm no longer going to be this archetypically unmanageable fae. I'm no longer going to be this conflicted human. I was just kind of like, even pursuing that feels banal to me. It just feels like a rejection of all the potential of being the mess that you are as a changeling.
The readings from this conversation were from Second Chances by Charles DeLint and A Case for Queer Childhood Horror in the World of Darkness by Victor Kinzer. The music from this episode was LSD by Mon Plaisir.
Today's Badly Explained Echo. The nettle jumper is just so itchy.